You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, our guest says it's time for Republicans and Democrats to come together and make tough choices to avoid a debt-based calamity. We'll find out what he has in mind for the federal deficit. First, the historically diverse array of Democratic presidential candidates features a record 6 women in the race. Of those 6, Senators Kamala Harris of California and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts are making up ground in the polls and are considered serious contenders for the nomination at this point. Their popularity has brought back conversations about gender that played out during the 2016 presidential election, when Hillary Clinton became the first woman ever to be nominated for president on a major party ticket. Picking a nominee often requires Democrats to consider who has the best shot at beating President Trump. Some polls show a candidate's gender is something voters are taking into account. Erin Cassess is an associate professor of political science at the University of Delaware. Her research focuses on the behavior of women as voters and as candidates. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, talk to us about what you're seeing so far early in this election when it comes to whether voters, especially Democratic primary voters, are ready to vote for women running for office.
Sure. So I think a lot of people are asking whether this question about electability is really about gender. It's really a question about, is the country ready for a woman president? Can a woman win the Midwest? And I think that in a lot of ways, this kind of concern conflates Clinton's loss with her gender. So it cast female candidates as risky choices. And while sexism definitely played a role in 2016, there were a lot of other factors. So Clinton's strategy in the Midwest and her small number of visits to Michigan and Wisconsin have been criticized, and nationwide, right? Black turnout was low. So whoever wins the nomination is going to be tuned to those problems and adjust their strategy accordingly.
Now, there's some interesting polling out there, and I think you've talked about this in the past, where when you ask voters, would you vote for a woman running for president? Most people say, yeah. But if you ask them if they think other people would vote for a woman running for president, a lot of people say no. What's up with that?
Well, I think there's debate over what that difference actually means. So some people think it's a way for people to express bias without having to go right out and say that they wouldn't vote for a female president. And other people think that it's reflecting something people are seeing in their social context. So they really are willing to vote for a female president, but they're getting some kind of vibe or hearing some kind of comments in their social circles that are making them doubt this. The way the polling question is worded actually makes me think of some of the polls that were conducted in 2016, where pollsters asked not about vote choice, but about who people think will win. And the idea was kind of the same, that maybe we're going to get this informal tally of social networks. And it turned out that the answers to those questions were not really predictive of the outcome of the presidential race, and that mostly what people were picking up on with those questions was how people were processing what they were seeing in the media. So, the disconnect between people saying they would vote for a woman and their neighbors not voting for a woman might be a reflection of this broader electability narrative and media stories about whether the country is ready for a female president.
Talking to Erin Cassess, associate professor of political science at the University of Delaware. We're talking about women running for president, and we'll talk some about women voting for people running for president, whether candidates are held to different standards if they're men or women, by the media, by voters, by each other. And you can join in on the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a woman running on the Democratic side of things? Are you hoping to see a woman as president in 2020 or in this decade? What do you see as some of the challenges facing women running for office? If you're a woman who's run for office successfully or otherwise, local, statewide, or beyond, love to hear from you and your experiences, whether you think you were treated differently in any way as a candidate. Again, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Erin, this is kind of a unique situation on the Democratic primary, about 24 candidates, and it's hard to stand out for men or women. Do you see the women in this primary race in particular getting different kinds of questions in the media than the men in the field?
Well, I don't think that they're necessarily getting different kinds of questions. I think, you know, most of the candidates are really being questioned about their records and their qualifications. I think at this level, that makes sense, right? Research on down ballot races, like looking at congressional races, shows that female candidates sometimes have a greater scrutiny of their qualifications. So that's one way that gender bias can show up. So to give an example from the 2018 midterms, incumbent Republican Senator from Nevada, Dean Heller, released this campaign ad that suggested his opponent, Jackie Rosen, fabricated parts of her resume. Right? So Rosen ended up producing documentation to show that she really had those degrees and then went on to win the race. But I think it's just like a particularly salient example of questioning female candidates on their qualifications.
Do we associate different characteristics with men and different characteristics with women when they're running for office? Is there research on what kind of traits voters assign to men versus women?
Sure. So there's differences based on traits, and then there's also differences based on policy issues, like which policy issues they're going to be more or less competent on. And those tend to fall along kind of stereotypical gendered lines. So women are perceived as being more collaborative, warmer, more caring, you know, more constituent-oriented in that kind of empathic way, whereas male candidates have stereotypic associations that are more kind of agentic, right, or independent, aggressive, what we typically think of as stereotypes associated with leadership.
Do we know if there's a portion of the American electorate who will flat out not vote for a woman for an office like president?
There are, I guess, some things that we can look at to indicate how willing voters are. So some of the social science research tries to quantify voters' levels of sexism using surveys. And so one of the kinds of sexism that we look at is called hostile sexism. And this is really this kind of hostility toward upending traditional gender roles, right? Kind of wanting to maintain stereotypic paths for men and women and qualities for men and women. And people who score high on those survey measures show a lot of resistance to women's leadership. And it was associated with not turning out to vote, right, among Democratic men, and then also having a preference for Donald Trump among voters as a whole.
Is it, we hear a lot about partisan identity being really strong in the United States. Does it seem likely that sexism would be enough to get somebody to switch their vote from Democrat to Republican or vice versa?
It's pretty unlikely in this era of polarization. I think the concern might be that people would not turn out to vote. So it would depress turnout as opposed to causing a party switching. So just like, you know, women won't cross party lines to vote for other women, don't think that people who are high on hostile sexism would cross party lines to vote for a member of the opposing party.
Now, we've seen moments where women running for office will reference gender in response to criticisms from fellow candidates. I want to give a listen to Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar.
And I am the only candidate here who has passed a law protecting a woman's right of reproductive health and health insurance. And I'm the only candidate who has passed a public option. And I respect everybody's goals and plans here. But we do have one candidate that's actually advanced the ball. And we got to have access for everyone. I've done it as a public option.
Senator Klobuchar, I want to get you. I'm fascinated by this, Senator Klobuchar.
I just want to say there's three women up here that have fought pretty hard for a woman's right to choose. So I'll start with that.
Jay Inslee, Governor Jay Inslee, starting that off, and then Senator Klobuchar. What do you make of a moment like that?
Sure. I think that Klobuchar is kind of interjecting, using gender as a credential, saying, like, this is an area that we think of as a woman's issue. There are women up here who've made this a priority and who've taken a lot of legislative action on this. And I think that is a way that gender can be used kind of to advance and to kind of cement that policy objective. female candidates also do that sometimes with motherhood. So you'll hear the candidates talking about how their focus on childcare policy is motivated by their own experiences as mothers and struggling to pay the cost of childcare. So we see that all the female candidates have pretty well articulated positions on reproductive rights and also on childcare.
Talking to Erin Cusses, a professor of political science at the University of Delaware, looking at gender and the 2020 presidential election. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on how women are treated by the media, by voters, by other candidates when they run for office? Do you take gender into account when deciding whether or not to support a political candidate? How is this all playing into the 2020 presidential race, the Democratic primaries? Have you run for office if you're a woman? Love to hear your story. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with political science professor Erin Cusses from the University of Delaware, looking at how gender factors into the 2020 presidential election. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. A lot of women running on the Democratic side of things. Do you see them being treated differently in the media? Do you think women are held to different standards than men when they run for office? Do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Gender and race do not qualify nor disqualify anybody. What matters is what they will do for us.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Erin, is that the norm? Is that how most people think, or at least say they think?
I think it depends. Some people feel that having a representative who shares a characteristic with them, like gender, like race, means that they have a set of common experiences to draw on, and that person is going to make policy from, you know, that place of experience. For other people, right, they're less interested in having a descriptive representative, and they're more focused on the specific messaging. So I think it kind of depends on what you're looking for in a candidate.
Dennis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Ned joins us now in Eau Claire. Ned, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I would like to see Elizabeth Warren be our first woman president. I think it's high time we had a woman. Great Britain's had a woman. And I think that, you know, you just talked about messaging. I think she's right on with the messaging that we need for this country on race, the environment, the economy, education, all kinds of issues. And I would feel very confident voting for her. I think that she can debate well. She's articulate and she's smart. And I would love it if she was our first woman president.
Ned, thanks a lot for the call. I've seen some suggestions, Erin, that as a candidate, like in this case, Elizabeth Warren, when we see people just as generic candidates, we might see men and women differently. As we get more contact with them, see them talk more, hear their policies, we see them more as individual candidates and judge them more on that sort of thing. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Stereotypes matter most when we have the least information about the candidates. And because we're at such an early stage in the primary race, this might be, you know, a time when stereotypes are having their maximum effect. The good news is that people are increasingly paying attention to the campaign. I think Pew released some data today that said 63% of Americans are paying attention to the race already, and that's a record high. We had record viewership for the primary, or for the debates, rather. And so all of this is giving people more information to help them really start to see the candidates in an individualized way.
A question that comes up sometimes is likability for any candidate, men or women. Did I see something that said that being seen as disliked is worse for a woman running off for office than it is for a man? Say if you have two historically unpopular or disliked candidates like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, it might hurt the woman more than the man in that case?
Sure. So researchers call this the double bind. And the double bind is that women are evaluated in terms of their warmth and their competence. And they really have to hold on to both. Likeability, it kind of relates to this warmth dimension. If you go too far in one direction, like focusing too more on competence and qualifications, women risk being seen low on this warmth dimension as being unlikable. And if they're, you know, stressing these more warmer characteristics, they might be seen as likable but less competent. So the double bind is how to navigate those expectations that candidates be seen as both warm and competent.
Talking to Erin Cassess from the University of Delaware, looking at women running for office in 2020 and beyond. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Erin, do we know if there's a partisan split on how people perceive women running for office? Do things work differently for Republicans and Democrats?
There is a split, and there's more demand for descriptive representation, for women's representation on the Democratic side of the aisle. So if you ask Democrats and Republicans, you know, how important is it to have a woman represent you, the percentages are much higher on the Democratic side and only about 20% on the Republican side. So it's just not as much of a priority for Republican women compared to Democratic women.
Now, let's turn to voters for a moment. I know it's impossible to say that there's such a thing as that all women vote in a particular way. There's a lot of diversity in women, of course. But are there calculated appeals from either party to try to get women on their side? And how do those play out?
Well, I think you're right that there is a lot of diversity among women. Women are prioritizing different issues. So I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren has this child care cost calculator that's kind of translating what her policy initiatives would mean in terms of concrete dollars in your pocket. But something like that isn't just going to apply to female candidates or to female voters, rather. And those kinds of numbers are of interest to both male and female voters, I think.
Let's bring in another caller now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. A lot of the discussion with the squad of Congresswomen, you notice that at Trump rallies, even going back as far as 2016, the only chanting they did for lock her up or send her home or any of that are for women. They don't do that for men. They've never done that for Pete Buttigieg or for Bernie Sanders or anybody. It's underlying misogyny is even worse than the underlying race question.
Tom, thanks for the call. Erin, what do you think?
And it's hard to say, you know, if it's race or if it's gender. I think both of these are at play here. But the chants are definitely revealing a kind of punitive attitude towards women. So lock her up is like punishing Clinton for her perceived transgressions. Sending them home, you know, is making people leave the country on the basis of, you know, who they are and what they've said in the past. So I think that the thing to focus on is that there's kind of a punitive orientation behind it. And then the debate that people are having now is this dangerous, right? Is this language inciting people to violence? Is it kind of a dog whistle?
Tom, thanks for the call. We saw in the 2018 midterms, Erin, I think records for both how many women ran for Congress and how many women won. Do you see it as an indicator of a long-term change?
I think we did see a lot of historic firsts in 2018, and that might be the trajectory of the party right now. First, in terms of racial and ethnic diversity of candidates, sexual orientation, and religiosity, all of these different factors. So I think there's a lot of room for expanding how we think about leadership and who's going to be a viable candidate in 2020.
Do voters look at women differently if they're running for legislative office, Congress or state legislature, say, versus executive office, a president, a governor, a mayor?
Definitely. Our expectations for members of deliberative bodies are very different than for executive positions. The kind of masculine associations with executive positions are much more magnified. Meredith Conroy wrote this book called Masculinity, the Media, and American Presidency. And she argues that the presidential races are always about masculinity, even when men run against each other. Right? So it's kind of a contest, kind of the way Biden challenged Trump to a push-up contest the other day on Morning Joe. So women, when they're running in the presidential race, have to overcome this mismatch between stereotypes of the office and stereotypes we have about women leaders.
Also, over the last few years, we've seen a lot of things that put issues of gender in the forefront of political conversations, accusations of sexual assault by the president, more recent ones as well, the nomination and confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, moves to overturn Roe versus Wade. these issues being put into the spotlight, does that change things when it comes to gender and women running for office?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that some of the candidates have been more explicit with their connection to the Me Too movement than others. For Kirsten Gillibrand, some of the criticisms that she's been getting are that she was maybe, too aggressive in pursuing Franken's ouster, and that it represents the overreach of the Me Too movement. So I think candidates are forced to engage in their past record on these issues and also to answer questions on them because they continue to be a salient and at the forefront of the minds of voters.
Well, in about 2 years, Aaron, you and your colleagues in political science are going to have a lot of data to work with from the 2020 mm-hmm. elections. What kind of things, what kind of trends are you going to be watching for?
I'm looking at the way that hostile sexism impacts how people are paying attention to campaigns, how they're engaging with campaigns, and affecting election outcomes. And I think sexism is an important bias to understand in the country, but it's not necessarily the case that the existence of this bias should really drive our political strategies. So I'm trying to understand how it operates in these election contexts at different levels of office.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Aaron Cassess is an associate professor of political science at the University of Delaware. She joined us today to talk about gender and the 2020 presidential elections.